Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anne Ball, Brian Lynn, and Christopher Jones Cruz. Later, Steve Ember will have a special Making of a Nation report on the Second World War. But first, Anne Ball and Brian Lynn bring us this week's Science in the News report.
Each year, more ice disappears from the Arctic Ocean. A new study blames human activity for the loss. The damage is caused, the study says, by greenhouse gases coming from vehicles, airplanes, and other human activities. These gases capture heat and warm the atmosphere, melting the ice. The study was published in the journal Science. Greenhouse gases are produced when fuel is burned to take a passenger on a flight from New York to Europe, or a person driving 4,000 kilometers in a gasoline-powered car. These activities emit enough heat-trapping gas to melt 3 square meters of ice on the Arctic Ocean, according to the study.
There is a very clear linear relationship between carbon dioxide emissions and sea ice retreat in September, according to Dirk Knotts. He is a climate scientist at Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Germany and the study's lead author. He said this is especially the case at the southern boundaries of the Arctic Ocean. It's very simple. Those emissions from our tailpipes and our coal-fired power plants are all going into the atmosphere, said Julian Struva, a co-author of the study. She is a climate scientist at both the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, and University College in London. The study said limits on the increase in the world's temperature called for in the Paris Agreement on climate change are not enough for the Arctic summer sea ice to survive. The Paris Agreement calls for keeping the global rise in temperature to below 2 degrees Celsius. The study said at current carbon emission amounts, the ocean around the North Pole would likely be ice-free in September in about 30 years.
Our next story comes from a star not too far from our own sun. More details are coming out about the nearest exoplanet to our own solar system. In August, a team of astronomers announced that they had discovered a small planet. They called the planet Proxima B. It orbits the star Proxima Centauri. It is the closest planet to our solar system, a little more than 4 light-years away from our sun. The scientists said the planet appears to be in the so-called Goldilocks zone, meaning the conditions there could support life.
Last Monday, a group searching for intelligent life beyond Earth, called Breakthrough Listen, announced a new effort. Breakthrough Listen said it is using the Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia to listen for possible life on Proxima B. As the closest known exoplanet, Proxima B is also the main target for Breakthrough Listen's partner program, Breakthrough Starshot. That program is developing technology to send small spacecraft to explore our nearest stars.
A recent study published in the astrophysical journal Letters provided more details about Proxima B. It says that the conditions on the planet increase the chances that it can support life. Researchers say Proxima B could be an ocean planet. It may be covered with the same kind of oceans below its surface that might exist on some of the moons orbiting the planets Jupiter and Saturn. A team of researchers from the Marseille Astrophysics Laboratory said Proxima B could be an ocean planet with an ocean covering its entire surface. The size and qualities of the planet favor its habitability, they said. The study also finds that Proxima B, like Mercury in our solar system, has a metal core, the inside part of the planet. Researchers say its core accounts for 2/3 of its mass. They add that its mass is similar to Earth.
The U.S. Space Agency, NASA, says it looks forward to additional research to know about the radius of the planet. Without knowing the radius, it is impossible to know what the planet looks like or what it is made of. The radius of a planet sometimes is measured during transit, when it passes in front of a star. But Proxima B is not known to transit. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Ann Ball.
A show with more than 60 of the most important manuscripts of and about the Quran opened recently in Washington, D.C. The books and documents were created over more than 1,000 years in countries across the Islamic world, from North Africa to Turkey, Iran, and Afghanistan. The Art of the Quran is the first major exhibition of its kind in the United States. It can be seen at the Arthur M. Sackler Gallery, which is part of the world-famous Smithsonian Institution. Masume Farhad is the chief curator of the Sackler Gallery. She is also responsible for its collection of Islamic art. She talked about the first thing visitors to the exhibit see, a very colorful, large manuscript.
It certainly is one of the biggest. It's certainly the heaviest. It weighs some 60 kilos, and it is quite remarkable. Many of these manuscripts were created primarily for display. They were given as gifts to mosques and mausolea.
Most of the exhibit's manuscripts are from the Museum of Turkish and Islamic Arts in Istanbul. Others are from the Smithsonian's permanent collection. The oldest were produced in 7th century Damascus, Syria, while the most recent works are from 17th century Istanbul. Some works come from the burial places of Ottoman sultans in what is now Turkey. The sultan's power once extended from Southeast Europe to Northern Africa and the Middle East.
They were created for some of the most powerful sultans, rulers in these regions. And eventually, after many years, they were acquired by the Ottoman royal family.
Masume Farhad says, although each book or document has the same wording, they look different in appearance. She says the skill of the artists has made each manuscript a special work of art.
For instance, there is a manuscript by the calligrapher Yakut, who is probably one of the greatest calligraphers to have ever worked in the Islamic world from the late 12th, early 13th century.
The exhibit shows the beauty of the calligraphy and the extremely fine details of the Qurans. It also tells the stories of some of the manuscripts, their makers and earlier owners.
We hope that visitors, whatever their interests, will come and take away some of these stories. Some may be interested in the calligraphy, some may be interested in particular calligraphers or in the art of illumination. And the way that the exhibition is organized, we hope that we have something for all our visitors.
The Quran exhibit continues at the Sackler Gallery through February 20th, 2017. Many parts of the show can be seen online. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
On Election Day, American voters decided more than who would go to the White House next year. Voters in 35 states were asked to decide more than 150 policy questions, such as legalizing use of the drug marijuana and restrictions on gun ownership. Voters in Arkansas, Florida, Montana, and North Dakota approved measures to permit marijuana use for medical purposes. A majority of states now let patients use the drug for some medical conditions. In California, Maine, and Massachusetts, people over 21 may now use marijuana even without a medical need. But voters in Arizona rejected the legalization of recreational marijuana. California voters approved a measure to severely limit people's ability to buy ammunition for large guns. In the state of Washington, voters approved a plan to temporarily ban people who show signs of mental problems or violence from possessing a gun. In Nevada, voters passed a measure to expand investigations into individuals taking part in nearly all private sales and exchanges of guns. But a similar measure failed in Maine. Californians rejected a measure to end the state's right to use execution as a way to punish criminals. In Nebraska, voters agreed to reestablish a court's right to sentence some prisoners to death. And in Oklahoma, residents approved a measure to make it harder to cancel the death penalty. California voters made it easier for schools to teach in languages other than English. And in Georgia, voters said the state cannot take control of public schools that fail year after year. Voters in the District of Columbia approved a measure to make the U.S. Capitol the 51st state. The decision has no immediate effect. Instead, voters say they hope their opinion puts pressure on the next government to end D.C.'s lack of representation in Congress.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Embers. World War II ended with an action that was never taken before in the history of warfare and has never been taken since. It required the efforts of a team of scientists. Working in secrecy, they designed and built the first atomic bombs. President Harry S. Truman made the decision to use these weapons against Japan in August of 1945.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
America's use of atomic weapons brought years of conflict in Europe and the Pacific to an end. But it also marked the beginning of the nuclear age. And it represented, in a dramatic way, the growing importance of science and technology in modern times. Interest in science goes back to the earliest days of the nation. President Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were famous not only as political leaders, but also as inventors and scientists. President Abraham Lincoln and Congress established the National Academy of Sciences during the Civil War in the 1860s. And in the early 1900s, the nation created scientific offices to study and improve agriculture, public health, even air travel. By the start of World War I in 1914, the federal government was employing scientists in many areas of work. President Woodrow Wilson created the National Research Council to organize the work of scientists and engineers to win the war. However, before World War II, government support for science was generally limited. The government was willing to pay for research only to meet certain clear goals, such as better weapons or military transport systems. World War II greatly changed the traditionally limited relationship between American scientists and the federal government. In the early years of the war, the German forces of Adolf Hitler showed the world the power of their new tanks, guns, and other weapons. President Franklin Roosevelt knew that the United States would need to develop modern weapons of its own if it entered the war. For this reason, Roosevelt established a National Defense Research Committee in 1940 to support and organize research on weapons. The new committee included some of the top scientists in America. Among its members were the presidents of Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Bell Laboratories. The committee did its work so well that Roosevelt later formed an even more powerful Office of Scientific Research and Development. The leader of both groups was Vannevar Bush, no relation to the future presidents. He had long experience as a professor of electrical engineering and as an inventor. Many scientists knew him. Vannevar Bush put together a hard-working team, and in the years that followed, American scientists and engineers developed one invention after another to help the war effort. Scientists developed new devices to help the Navy find German submarines. They improved methods for bombers to find their targets, and they developed more powerful rockets to protect American troops when they landed on foreign beaches. American scientists and doctors also made great progress in improving the methods of wartime medicine. World War II may well have been the first war in history in which a wounded soldier was more likely to survive than to die. But in many ways, the most important scientific development of the period was the atomic bomb. In 1939, Albert Einstein wrote President Roosevelt a letter. The scientist told the president that it might soon be possible to build a powerful weapon, a weapon that would use the power of the atom. And he urged Roosevelt to get American scientists to build the atomic bomb before German scientists could build one. Roosevelt agreed. He created a special team of scientists. Their work became known as the Manhattan Project. Roosevelt made sure that these scientists got all the money and supplies they needed. Roosevelt died before the scientists could complete their work. But in April 1945, the scientists told the new president, Harry Truman, that they were almost ready to test their invention. Just 3 months later, they exploded the world's first atomic bomb in the desert in the southwestern state of New Mexico. Truman had to make a difficult decision. He knew the atomic bomb would cause widespread death and suffering if it was used on a Japanese city. But he was willing to do anything to avoid the need for American troops to invade Japan. In Japan, a new prime minister and government were searching for a way to end the war. But Truman believed that the Japanese were still not ready to surrender, and he felt it was his duty to end the war as soon as possible. On August 6, 1945, the first atomic bomb fell on the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, a second A-bomb fell on the city of Nagasaki.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us.
President Truman.
It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemies. And we pray that he may guide us to use it in his ways and for his purposes.
The Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Japan estimates that between 150,000 and 246,000 people died within 2 to 4 months of the bombings. The bombings left Japan's rulers with no choice. In less than 1 week, they surrendered.
I received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan. In the reply, there is no qualification. Arrangements are now being made for the formal signing of the surrender terms at the earliest possible moment. General Douglas MacArthur has been appointed the Supreme Allied Commander to receive the Japanese surrender.
In this newsreel, we hear General MacArthur accepting the surrender of the Japanese Empire.
The battleship Missouri, 53,000-ton flagship of Admiral Halsey's Third Fleet, becomes the scene of an unforgettable ceremony marking the complete and formal surrender of Japan. General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Allied Commander for the occupation of Japan, boards the Missouri. Fleet Admiral Nimitz, Pacific Fleet Commander, and Admiral Halsey welcome MacArthur and his Chief of Staff, General Sutherland, aboard. It is Sunday, September 2nd, 1945.
We are gathered here, representatives of the major warring powers, to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored. The issues involving divergent ideals and ideologies have been determined on the battlefields of the world, and hence are not for our discussion or debate. The terms and conditions upon which surrender of the Japanese Imperial Forces is here to be given and accepted are contained in the instrument of surrender now before you. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated.
American scientists and engineers proved that a war could be won with research as well as bullets. And all Americans learned how much could be gained when government agencies, scientists, and universities worked together for common goals. Roosevelt had understood this long before the war ended. He asked Vannevar Bush to study how the federal government could work with scientists and universities in peacetime. Bush offered a number of ideas to President Truman at the end of the war. He told the president that science was important to America's progress and safety. He called on the federal government to support scientific study and education. Professor Bush said that the nation's universities should be greatly strengthened. He called for the creation of a new government agency to provide money for science projects. Truman and Congress agreed with Vannevar Bush, and in the next few years, American research efforts expanded. In 1946, the Office of Naval Research was created to support basic science study in universities. In the same year, the government created the Atomic Energy Commission. And in 1950, it created the National Science Foundation to provide support to thousands of the nation's best scientists. In the years that followed, American science would grow beyond the wildest dreams of Vannevar Bush and other scientists of his time. Universities would add thousands of new students, along with new laboratories and research centers. By the middle of the 1960s, the federal government would spend more than $13 billion a year for research and development. And 500 new centers of higher learning would be created. All this investment would help make the United States the world leader in such fields as computer science, genetics, and space travel.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.